Funding for Think comes from SMU Graduate Liberal Studies programs.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. Why does the universe contain matter? As scientists pursue a deeper understanding of all that exists as a result of the Big Bang, they are recognizing that fundamental subatomic particles called neutrinos may offer important clues. Neutrinos are invisible, even under the greatest possible magnification, and they have the ability to pass through most objects without affecting them in any way. So one way to study them is to build a special kind of detector that works with a particle accelerator. The National Science Foundation and U.S. Department of Energy are currently funding such a project known as NOVA, and the new supercomputer at SMU is lending processing hours of $4 million a year to the effort. Thomas Cohn is here to tell us more. He is Associate Professor of Physics at SMU. Tom, welcome to Think.
Glad to be here, Chris.
All right, we'll start at the beginning. Most of us learned in school about protons, neutrons, and electrons. Where do neutrinos fit into this as subatomic particles?
Okay, neutrinos are the second most common particle in the universe. You're not so familiar with them because they don't form atoms, so they don't. You can't make them into cakes, Pinot Noir, so on. So they are electrically neutral guys, which has lots of advantages. Principally, it means they can go a very long way in our galaxy without being steered away or diverted by the magnetic field that exists in our galaxy. So they can be used, for example, as a probe of things that happen at the center of our galaxy. So they also have a bunch of other interesting properties. They have no known size, and that always seems to make people freak out a little bit. They're a little bit like those points that you maybe have forgotten from high school geometry. I mean, they at least two of them have mass, but they have no known size, which if you try to wrap your head around is kind of an obvious or kind of a difficult concept to grasp, at least for me. But again, the reason you're not familiar with them is they don't form any sort of structures. They're sort of free spirits, and in fact, they don't even like to interact with the matter that makes up this table or your house. They really are very strange objects, and that's their fascination. Why people like to study them.
How did we figure out they existed at all?
Oh, okay, yeah, no, this is a good story. So they were first speculated about, theorized in about 1930, and it was an act of desperation, and it was an attempt to rescue one of the holy grails of physics, which is conservation of energy in any process. The energy gets divvied up in various ways, but you don't lose it and you don't gain it. So fellow Wolfgang Pauli speculated that there was this particle, the neutrino, it stands for the little neutral one. He didn't coin the term. It was an Italian guy, Enrico Fermi. And he needed this particle because, again, he wanted to save this important principle. And at the time, it was thought that it was crazy because the particle was going to be massless. It would be very difficult to detect. So it took about 26 years till the mid-50s. Two guys, Reines and Cohen, using a nuclear reactor in order to actually detect the neutrino. And you needed a huge source of neutrinos in order to just to detect one of them because they interact, again, so feebly with matter. Originally, Reines and Cowan wanted to use a nuclear—at least one of them was at Los Alamos. Originally, they wanted to use a nuclear explosion to try to detect it, and their supervisor had a better idea.
Somebody put the kibosh on that. Yeah.
Somebody had a better idea. Why don't you use a nuclear reactor? So it's Savannah River in South Carolina. They had detector made a so-called liquid scintillator, which basically is just baby oil doped with a fluor, and you put it next to a nuclear reactor. Nuclear reactors produce copious amounts of neutrinos. And again, you needed a very bright source of neutrinos in order just to detect a few of them. And that's, in fact, is one of the problems with the technique for studying them, because they interact so feebly with matter. I mean, the standard sort of yardstick is you need to send one neutrino through a light year's distance worth of lead. So that's take light, turn your laser pointer on, let the laser pointer run out for a whole year. So that's a long distance. Turn that long distance into lead, and that's how much path length of matter you need the neutrino to go through in order for it to interact with the lead. So they interact just extraordinarily feebly. So that means you need either an extremely intense source, nuclear bomb, nuclear reactor, or you need a detector which has an enormous amount of mass. So if you look at all kinds of neutrino detectors, I mean, it's a worldwide business. It really hums along. Typically, the detectors are in thousands of tons of various stuff. Could be ice. My experiment, it's liquid scintillator. But in general, you just need lots of material in order to detect just a few of these guys.
So neutrinos are passing through everything, including human bodies. And the figure that stuck with me from the materials I received were 100,000 billion particles per second just passing through you and me right here.
Yeah, the sun, neutrinos are produced in a wide variety of venues. So nuclear explosions, okay, fortunately not too many of those. Nuclear reactors. But the sun is the biggest local source for neutrinos. We do the fusion reactions that take place, the reactions that power the sun. So you get about 65 billion neutrinos per second through your thumbnail. So depending whether you're skinny or not skinny, you get a lesser or greater amount that pass through you. So it's just an extraordinary thing. But because they interact so feebly, you're completely oblivious to the fact that this is going on. There are also a much smaller amount of neutrinos left over from the Big Bang. So if you take a sugar cube, so it's that sort of volume, you have about 300 or so left over from the Big Bang. Now, those have never been detected, and they're going to be very hard to actually detect because they have low energy. So that's a toughie to do. But nonetheless, you do have this residue left over from the Big Bang. But for the ones from the sun, you can detect those, and they have been detected. The ones that neutrinos come in a variety of energy. It's in general, the more energetic they are, the easier it is they interact with matter. So they're easier to see. So these experiments that are peppered all over the world. They look at a variety of energies of neutrinos with slightly different technologies. So some people have a slightly easier job than others. But the trying to detect the neutrinos left over from the Big Bang, that's going to be a real tour de force to try to do that. That is not an easy thing to do.
If we could find them, detect those specific neutrinos, what could they tell us?
Well, first of all, it would be it'd be another confirmation that the details of the Big Bang are correct. You learn in science, it's easy for things that are plausible to be wrong, and you would really like to get all the details right, because surprises do happen. So I would say the principal advantage would be aesthetic or intellectual. In the sense that, okay, we really understand what we're talking about. It would be embarrassing, I guess. Humiliating, embarrassing. Embarrassing if you had this wonderful theory which was only partially correct and you didn't go the extra step of sort of dotting all the I's, crossing all the T's. I mean, it's sort of the way science works. You want to get to the heart of the matter.
It's a nice pun there.
And so as far as practical applications, yeah, you always get asked for that. For neutrinos, it's the catty response is, tell me what your life is like and I'll tell you what's practical. But for neutrinos, for example, they can be used to detect, nuclear explosions where other techniques there have been schemes if there have been various schemes of different levels of practicality to mount neutrino detectors around, for example, North Korea. I'm not going to comment on go into detail about how practical that is, but that's one technique. But the probably greatest utility right now is still in science. I mentioned this before. It's because they're electrically neutral, they're insensitive to this magnetic field that permeates the galaxy. So you're able to use them as probes, for example, of what's happening at the center of the galaxy, which is a very messy place. There's lots of dust. There's bright objects. So it's hard to know what's going on, whereas the neutrinos, because they don't interact with matter, they can just plow through stuff.
Well, let me interrupt you. I totally get that, but it's not like you can, you know, mount a teeny tiny camera on these things. If you send them as probes to parts of the galaxy that we can't otherwise access, how can we find out what they have traveled through?
So you can measure, for example, their energy. And it turns out that they come in three flavors. One is related to the electron, which we all know and love, responsible for chemistry. And the other two are related to more exotic particles that we don't typically have too much everyday experience with, the so-called muon. They're passing through you right now, produced in the upper atmosphere. And then the so-called tau particle, which is even more exotic, so we'll leave that off the table. But certainly knowing the energy of the neutrinos, the flux of them, so the amount that's coming from a given direction, and also their flavor are clues as to what they propagated through and also what their source is. So they by themselves, nothing, of course, is ever conclusive. But putting those three pieces together gives you some handle, again, on what's actually producing them. So, for example, neutrinos are produced in supernovae. Supernovae are very, when the stars at the end of their life collapse and then bounce. It's a very chaotic situation. But neutrinos, again, their energy, the relative time at which they show up gives you clues as to how the supernova actually works in its final kaboom. They're not... they don't come at you banging a big drum and blowing a brass horn, but they are they do give you clues, again, about their origin and their trajectory through matter that are important.
We have an email here from Joey in Denton who says, back in 2012, American scientists sent a coherent neutrino message through 780 feet of rock using a particle accelerator. How far might this progress our communication abilities from where we are now?
I would just pick up myself. I mean, it isn't. Yeah, I'm going to have to punt on that because although certainly it's easy to send neutrinos through lots of material because they don't interact very much. The point of sending this seems to have been, could you actually convey some sort of useful information using neutrinos? That's important simply because neutrinos are so difficult to detect and to manipulate. Where it's going to lead, geez, I don't know.
We're speaking this hour with Thomas Cohn. He is Associate Professor of Physics at SMU. We're talking about neutrinos and what they can reveal about the universe. If you'd like to be part of the conversation, call 1-800-933-5372. You can also email think@kera.org or send me a tweet at Chris Boyd Think.
Funding for Think comes from SMU Graduate Liberal Studies programs. Accepting applications for January to design your own Master of Liberal Studies degree at SMU with concentrations in Global Studies, Creative Writing, and Organizational Dynamics. More at smu.edu/MLS.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. We're speaking this hour about neutrinos and what they can reveal about the universe with Thomas Kohn, who's Associate Professor of Physics at SMU. You can join us at 1-800-933-5372 or email think at kera.org. Okay, Tom, how do you catch a neutrino and what do you do with it when you've caught it?
Yeah, okay, so neutrinos have this curious feature that you don't actually ever observe them directly. What you do is you observe the debris they create when they run into the atoms in your detector. So typically a neutrino will come in and interact with, I'll just use the example of this liquid scintillator, which is baby oil, stuff you can buy at the drugstore.
But you're using 3 million gallons of it, we should
say. Well, yeah, and it's... using a lot, and also our baby oil is doped. We didn't use any babies, okay? It's doped with a fluor. So the neutrino comes in, has an interaction with the nuclei that make up whatever your detector is. In our case, it's baby oil. And then what gets produced could be an electron, again, which you know and love, a photon, a proton, this funny thing called a muon, which you can think of as a heavy cousin of an electron, which is radioactive. And muons, again, are these guys that are produced, they're elementary particles, and they're produced in the upper atmosphere, and they're coursing through your body all the time. In fact, if you hold your thumb out, you get about one per minute through your thumbnail. And then they can also, the neutrinos can also produce other exotic things called pions, which I won't talk about anymore. So in your detector, you see generally electrically charged particles and maybe some neutral ones. And these particles, they have some energy, so they travel some distance. And they lose their energy because they interact with subsequent atoms in your detector. And usually what happens is this energy is deposited in your detector, say in the doped baby oil. And then the doped baby oil fluoresces or fluors, so it produces a small amount of light. Too little for your eye to see, but you can observe the light with various electronic devices. So essentially what you see is a little splash of light which is distributed over some distance, the distance that the residual particles, the debris travels. And then it's the pattern of those light spots which allow you to determine what kind of particle was created in the collision. Was it an electron? Was it a proton? Was it a muon? So generally, the name of the game is to segment your detector in such a way so that it has kind of a – so it's sort of pixelated. So it's separated. So you see a patch of light here, a patch of light there, and it's the pattern of those pixels gives you a clue. Well, it is the clue. The only clue you really have is to – well, I guess the length of the length of the sequence of light patches would be another clue, but it's really this pixelization which allows you to identify what kind of particle was created, and it's the kind of particle that was created tells you the kind of neutrino that actually initiated the interaction, the collision. So again, you don't ever see the neutrino itself. It's sort of frustrating. They're just hard to study. It's unlike an electrons. You can see they persist in time, mm-hmm. And also they neutrinos do too. But the electrons persist in time, but they interact much more strongly with matter. So it's just easier to do it. But the neutrinos, no, those you don't see those guys directly. You just see the sort of the chaos, quote unquote, that they create.
So some of this, I guess, has to be measured digitally, electronically. And you guys at SMU now have this just massive supercomputer. People may have passed this big hulking building that is kind of right on the edge of 75 there at SMU. Talk about how, I mean, I know you're not a computer science guy, but how the processing power of that can be applied and sort of, okay, generally speaking, why that's useful and necessary to get to this next step of neutrino research.
Yeah, so generally, when you design an experiment, they're expensive, they take a long time, And so you need some way to design it in a rational in a rational, sensible way. So you, because you already know a lot about physics, you can simulate a lot about how your detector will respond based on how big you make it, how you segment it, if you change the materials of it, if you change the energy of the neutrinos that interact with it, and so on. So you end up doing a lot of hypothesis building, which helps you design the finer features. And there are literally thousands of decisions that you need to make. So you need a practical scheme sort of to do tests, but you can't do all the tests by actually building a physical object. First of all, you would run out of time. Well, firstly, you would run out of money, and, and then you would run out of time.
Right.
So you need the processing power in order to try very many different combinations, and particularly for neutrinos, because the interaction is so feeble, you need to start out with lots of neutrinos and at least on the computer, shoot them into your detector before you ever get a reaction that you care about. And so you might start with millions. And you have to generate them. I mean, what I mean by generate them, you have to give them certain properties in the appropriate fashion, in a random but controlled way, so that you're actually mimicking the physical process that you care about. And also, a lot of the processes that you care about are chained. It's not one thing that happens. You have to mimic a whole chain of processes. And so this just requires that you, that you have many physical processes that you need to describe. So you end up writing thousands and thousands and thousands of lines of code in order for this to occur. And so you just run lots of computer jobs, which take many days, in some cases weeks, for them to conclude. Generally, you don't like them to run for a week, because if the computer has a problem, then you lose all your results. But
is it like a, excuse me for interrupting, is it like a string of Christmas lights that if one goes out, everything's messed up?
No. So generally what you do, so it's not a single, people say it's a single supercomputer. Okay. But it's really a set of smaller computers which are packaged together.
Like a hive mind.
Yeah. So it's, and they don't even look like computers because they don't have screens and they're not in their individual boxes. I'm trying to remember what it looks. If you know what a relay rack looks like, then there are a bunch of those. If you don't know what that looks like, it looks like just a string of cabinets lined up one against the other. You'll have to hunt to even find a terminal because you talk to it through the terminal that's sitting on the desk in your room, in your office. But you have thousands of individual computers. So when you write your code, you'll submit a variety of programs, each which are slightly different. They have slightly different initial conditions or different properties, because that's what you want to test. And so you'll have one program will run on this machine, another program slightly different will run on the machine next to that, and so on and so forth. So you'll have maybe a thousand so-called jobs running simultaneously just to check one feature.
And you don't have to assign those. The system somehow says, okay, we'll send this over to these six machines, that sort of thing.
That's right. So there's software to sort of handle the drudgery of the traffic cop. Mm-hmm. So generally what you do is you know how long your – well, you estimate how long your job is going to last, because you don't want to miss. You don't want to launch a bunch of jobs and have it take 3 weeks to complete, because there's not much for you to do before in the ensuing 3 weeks, or the 3 weeks will finish in the middle of a vacation, and so on and so forth. So there's software that does the scheduling, which will find the free machines, which will orchestrate sending the results to various disk space, and so on. So essentially it's a fairly efficient process. I mean, people have been thinking about this for a long time. So you, even though there are thousands of actual individual computers, it's not like you have to direct traffic. Okay, there's software to direct the traffic.
Let's go to the phones now. 1-800-933-5372 is our number. I'm having a little trouble seeing the names on the screen, if we could minimize that in the other room. We have, let's see, on the line in Dallas, we have Jim. Hi, Jim.
Oh, hi. Yes, I'm just kind of baffled here. If neutrinos are massless, how do they carry energy? I don't get that at all.
Okay. Well, not all of them are massless, but possibly some of them are. But to answer your question, essentially in the same way that light, which has no mass, carries energy. You know, you can get a sunburn, you know, going outside. So the fact that something is massless doesn't mean it can't carry energy.
1-800-933-5372 is our number. Was there more? Is that the complete? That's it, right? That's okay. We have a tweet here from Beast, who asks, "Neutrinos, are these charged particles, and do they keep the universe together?"
No, they certainly are not charged, and no, they're not. They're not keeping the universe together. In fact, the universe seems to be expanding, which is a recent discovery. That's this whole business about dark energy, which is a relatively recent discovery. But no, they don't. They're not any sort of glue. Yeah, they don't. They don't form structures.
Are dark energy or dark matter made of neutrinos, or do they? How? What is the relationship between them?
Well, dark matter is a generic term. So anything that has mass and doesn't glow like a star is dark matter. So we're dark matter.
Mm-hmm.
Jupiter is a dark matter.
Ooh, that's very exciting to think about.
Dark chocolate is dark matter. But no, generally what people mean by dark matter is something beyond neutrinos. Dark matter is the matter that is not making up the matter that your chair is made up of, or the matter that your house is made from. I mean, it's a very mysterious entity. Not too much is known about it, and it's a very hot field of research. In fact, the curious thing is that if you look at where the energy density of the universe is distributed, about 5% or so is in the matter that we know and love, and the rest is divvied up between dark matter and dark energy, 20% or so for dark matter and the balance for dark energy. So you can interpret the matter that makes us up as either very special, or maybe we're just cosmic pollution. I mean, we're a minority. We're a minority in terms of the amount of energy that's invested in matter that makes up stars, planets, moons, people, and so on. So it's quite odd, actually.
1-800-933-5372 is our number. Let's go next on the phone to Hal in Dallas. Hey, Hal.
Hi, how are you, Chris?
Very well, thank you.
I love your show. You're a great resource for KERA.
Thank you.
Dr. Cohn, are neutrinos useful for studying black holes?
That's a good question. Not really. I'm not really an astrophysicist.
I like how you say I'm not really an astrophysicist.
Well, I'm not an astrophysicist. Yeah. Why hedge? Possibly what I hinted for in detail, I don't know how to answer your question. I'll just give you a general response is, you know, it's thought that there's a black hole at the center of our universe. And neutrinos are useful in the sense, again, because they can plow through so much matter without being stopped, that in principle that you might be able to and people are looking for this, you might be able to look for point sources of neutrinos at the center of the universe, which somehow might be able to give you some sort of information about, how the black hole, presumably at the center of our galaxy, is interacting with local matter. But beyond that, I can't give you a super crisp response.
Tom, at this point in our history, when there is so much scientific knowledge that we have gained and it's becoming more and more specialized, you know, when you talk about the universe expanding and everything moving farther away, I think in some ways that the specializations of scientists must be moving, farther away from each other in some ways, simply because there's so much deep knowledge to pursue.
Well, at least in physics, I mean, there's a lot of there's a lot of detail, that's true. But in physics, generally, most people kind of know what the big problems are mm-hmm. to work on. So what is dark matter? How do you characterize it as one? What is dark energy? That's a huge one. Why is there any matter at all in the universe and it's just not composed of light after the Big Bang? That's a biggie. So many of these questions, people sort of know where the action is. So a little bit earlier, there was a lot of, and rightfully so, there was a lot of froth about the discovery of the Higgs and so on. So that was also a big problem. But in terms of details, you're right. It is essentially impossible to read a journal article in a field that is not your own and understand it in depth. I mean, it's just too much. Knowledge that you need to bring to the paper in order to read it. Now, if you do want to read, of course, you can always stop and learn it, but that's likely to be a months long process.
So it's a tangent you don't undertake lightly.
Yeah. So you have to be actually very economical in what you read and what you study. And you also get generally most people tend to read authors, other physicists, that they can understand, because just you cannot read everything, period. And you really have to be picky. And some people are just lousy writers.
We're speaking this hour with SMU physicist Thomas Cohn. We're talking about neutrinos and what they might reveal about the universe. If you'd like to be part of the conversation, call us. The number is 1-800-933-5372. You can email think@kera.org or send me a tweet at Chris Boyd Think.
Funding for Think comes from SMU Graduate Liberal Studies programs. Accepting applications for January to design your own Master of Liberal Studies degree at SMU with concentrations in Global Studies, Creative Writing, and Organizational Dynamics. More at smu.edu/MLS.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. We're speaking this hour with Thomas Cohn, Associate Professor of Physics at SMU. We're talking about neutrinos and what they can reveal about the universe. If you'd like to join the conversation, call 1-800-933-5372 or email think@kera.org. So, Tom, tell us about the relationship between what you and your colleagues are doing at SMU and this Fermilab research into neutrinos and how everybody in different parts of the world will communicate about what they're discovering.
Yeah, so we're part of a collaboration called NOVA. That's the poetic name. And this is a group of about 200 physicists, 30-odd institutions from, I don't know, 6 or 7 countries. So at Fermilab, which is a large accelerator complex a little bit west of Chicago, there's an accelerator complex, which is the set of machines which produces neutrinos, and this is done simply by accelerating protons, so that's the stuff that makes up a glass of water in your hand, and rams them into a set of carbon fiber fins, and then the debris that comes out, some of that debris decays, and some of those decay products are neutrinos. So at the end of the day, you produce a beam of neutrinos, an intense beam, and it's shot, in my case, it's aimed towards two detectors, a near one, which is about a kilometer or so away, still on the site of Fermilab. Fermilab is about 6,000 acres or so. And then the beam continues on to the wilds of Minnesota. So we have a much larger detector farther away, just a little bit, about 40 minutes south of International Falls.
This is all underground, happening underground. Is that right?
Well, the first detector is underground. It's about 100 meters underground. And then the far detector sits essentially at the surface. So you're just 40 minutes from the Canadian border, and so we blasted out, or we paid someone to blast out a bathtub of sorts out of the granite, put a roof over the bathtub, and then our 14,000 kiloton detector sits in the bathtub. So what SMU does is it's a small group, so I lead it, and then I have a postdoc, Vladimir Kravtsov, and then I have a graduate student, Biao Wong, and they do a variety of things. Vladimir did an important job of trying to, in software, measure the actual shape of the detector. Now, you don't build 14,000 tons of anything in one. Well, maybe you do if you build a ship, but ours is built from essentially. Well, it's pixelated into 385,000 pieces. Now, we don't put together 385,000 or 360,000 pieces. Instead, we have about 12,000 pieces that were positioned together and then assembled in various blocks of stuff. And so what he was trying to do, he used a fancy laser system in order to measure how straight and or crooked, and how rotated or non-rotated each of these thousands of detector components were. So this is a large job, and it's necessary because again, when you want to identify the neutrino which interacted in your detector, you only know information about it by looking at the pattern that's produced after the collision. So if your detector is put together poorly, or you don't know how to, in software, put it together in the right position, then the pattern that you look at is completely crazy. It'd be like looking at a picture which is wildly out of focus. It'd be impossible to identify what you're looking at. So what he was he's finished it. What he was responsible for was trying to guarantee that the picture. The pixelization is in focus, and then later on he's looking at currently looking at fancy ways to identify more efficiently the kinds of particles that are produced after the collision. Again, the name of the game is you don't see the neutrino itself; you just see what it produces. So you have to be able to identify what it produces by looking at this pattern of pixelization, and then Bial does a variety of things. He's sort of on he is on call. So the detector is fairly fancy, and one of its aspects is, you in order to efficiently see the light which is produced produced from the effectively the pixels in the detector, you need to cool the electronics which views them. In order to do that, we use effectively beer coolers. You know, you've seen these things. You plug them in. Peltier effect is the fancy physics term, but it's beer cooler. So the electronics has these beer cooler. The electronic readout has a beer cooler attached to it. So you have to get the heat away from the beer cooler, and so there's a cooling system for that. Cooling systems are nasty because when they leak, water and electronics don't really like to play together very much. And because we have 12,000 of these depends how you count. I'll just say many thousands of electronic components. It's necessary that you carefully monitor the cooling system and that you fix problems quickly when there's a leak or they're not behaving properly and so on. So he's the guy that can get called in the middle of the night. What's going on? We have an alarm. Fix it. And then he's also – so that's sort of his technical service. Everybody gets a technical job. You have to do chores. It's not all publishing. And then for physics, what he's looking at right now, he just has started, he's looking at this curious effect that reflects the fact that the Earth has a magnetic field, and cosmic rays preferentially come from the west to the east as opposed to vice versa. And this can be used in a variety of ways as a diagnostic, and also has some astrophysics applications. So he's trying to make that measurement more more crisp, and then I have some other ideas for him to do. So that's the little group. So we are a single professor, postdoc, graduate student. So we're sort of on this probably slightly below average in size. I mean, there are certainly other institutions which are structured like we are. Mm-hmm. Okay, and there are other institutions which are larger. So the way we organize ourselves is it's a collaboration. So nobody pays anybody else's salary. So people just do this because they want to do it. And they also get money from Uncle Sam. I mean, the U.S. taxpayer pays for the salaries for the postdoc, for the graduate student, pays my summer salary and travel. But the way we organize ourselves, it's as a collaboration. It's not a voluntary organization. It's not like the Army. People, some people try to give orders, but people generally push back. So we meet as a group about four times a year, typically at Fermilab, but we've met at SMU, we've met at other places. We have a whole sequence of groups which divide the effort. So there's groups that work just on software, just on technical issues, electronic issues, when we were building, on construction issues. So you join a group, and then so there are lots of phone meetings that take place. Probably too many meetings, but they seem to be unavoidable. So you spend a lot of time in meeting, making presentations. So you generally, a physicist is a creature who produces plots. They don't produce books; they produce plots. So you just learn to make plots of various quantities, and then with some words of explanation. And people ask you about questions, or they show that you're wrong, or maybe they show that you're right. And so on. So there's a great emphasis is placed on oral communication, more so actually than writing. We do write technical notes, but the pace of information exchange is so large that you just have to get into the mode where you pay attention to people when they speak and when they produce the plots. And similarly, when you give your talks, you learn to produce results in a very efficient way. Not much fluff. Cut to the chase, so you have to learn great organizational skills. What do you present on the slides so people aren't confused? Just enough detail, but not too much. You don't want to waste people's time or confuse them or wear them out with just material that isn't important. So as a highlight, it's a great it's a great way for someone to become very good at speaking, because you yap a lot. You yap a lot. And physicists, despite their reputation, are an oddly social bunch. I mean, they clump together and they will talk your head off. They like the exchange of ideas. So it's a beehive of activity, but it's a consistent, again, it just, I guess to summarize, it's a consistent weekly set of phone conferences, and then periodically we meet together. So we have people call in from the UK. Most people are based in the US, even if they're not Americans, because it's more practical. But there's just a lot of verbal communication.
So are there pros and cons to having everybody geographically distributed and sort of
You're in the UK, they don't like those afternoon meetings.
It's late at night for them.
Yeah. I guess I was going to make a comment about the pubs, but I won't. Yeah, so for example, in the meeting I co-chair, which is the calibration group, we used to meet late in the afternoon, but we had to change that to 11 in the morning so that our UK colleagues who participate can participate at some reasonable hour. Fortunately, we don't have someone in Japan, because then it gets complicated if you're too geographically dispersed. There's just too many time zones. But for us, the major constraint is to make sure that our UK colleagues can participate in some hours. But, and it's hard to go much earlier than 11, because then you miss the Californians. Hmm. They don't like getting up. Physicists don't like getting up early in the morning, where early can be anywhere. Well, before noon can be troublesome for some folks. So 11 o'clock turns out to be a good time for us.
And does one set of experiments inevitably lead to the next? Will everyone sort of be on the same page about where you need to go when results come back in?
In general, you do get hints. I mean, experiments have a natural lifetime. So they have a certain amount of sensitivity based on how precisely they can measure things. And also based on how much data they can collect. And furthermore, based on the kind of systematic errors or uncertainties that are inherent in the measurement scheme. So after a while, it becomes not very useful to keep taking data. Yes, you get more data, but the techniques that you're using has just run out of steam. There's too much uncertainty, so you can't. So your result will have an uncertainty, say, of plus or minus 3%, and that's just inherent in the technique that you're using. So it doesn't matter that you collect more data. You don't. Your final uncertainty is not diminishing, in which case you give up, because it's just a waste of time and money to keep running the detector. And then you rely on brains to figure out a better technique to make the measurement that you wish to make.
And that's pretty creative work, right? Figuring out techniques to use.
That's right. I mean, that's sort of the fun is, yeah, I always get annoyed when people seem to think this idea the physicists sit under a tree and wait for the apple to conk themselves into the head.
I think even Newton would laugh at that.
I mean, that really is a large part of the creativity is figuring out the technique that's going to improve the current one, because there's no answer book to go to. All you know is your knowledge of physics, and then you just, I don't know where creativity comes from. I mean, you just start thinking about things and talking about it, and then you get the spark. And usually it's not – bigger is not always better. I mean, sometimes you just need a new and different technique. And that takes a while after the current experiment is over. Generally, you try to get some ideas before your current experiment runs out of steam.
Thomas Cohn is Associate Professor of Physics at SMU and an expert on neutrinos. Tom, thank you so much for spending this time with us.
Well, thank you.
Think is produced by Stephen Becker and engineered by Shelley Canavy. Lindsay Connect is assistant producer. Jeff Whittington is executive producer. You can contact the show via email at think@kera.org. Once again, I'm Chris Boyd. Thanks for listening and have a great day.